Good evening, boys and girls. The Highbury squad returns live, and inside the dressing room is back with a very special guest. You guys are going to enjoy this. Somehow I got these boys wearing hats. Okay, it's Lockdown Series, Volume 2, Episode 43, kids. And live from London is Mr. Super Kev, Super Kevin Campbell.
Boom! Hey, listen, I'm looking forward to this one. This guy is a top guy.
Me too. I've spoken to John Harkes a few times here since I've been based in the US. But John, welcome to the show and inside the dressing room. And thanks so much for joining us. I love it. But you have to tell everyone what happened when we came online. And I was wearing the hat because.
Yeah. I think, you know, we talk about inspiration and, you know, Sophie, you just wear it so well. And we can never, Kevin and I can never catch up to your level. But then Kevin broke out, you know, the little bonnet that he's got going on there. And, you know, he just looked very dapper. He was wearing it well. So I thought I had to dig into the old Dundee. My dad's from Dundee. And
love it.
And, you know, we got these in Edinburgh, actually. And so I said, hey, why not? So I'm trying. I'm trying to catch up to you two fashionistas, you know.
I love it. Absolutely love it. Well, listen, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And for all of the squaddies out there this evening, we know it's a Champions League evening, but the beauty of our show is you can listen live and also enjoy on replay and still be part of the conversation. It's brought to you by Football Prizes. Go to footballprizes.co.uk. There's not a Vinny Vieira, there's a Patrick Vieira signed shirt up for grabs, and we'll let you know that about that a little bit more after the show. Listen, our guest today is a true trailblazer when it comes to football. He's the first American to ever play in the old First Division, the first American to ever play in the Premier League, the first American to ever play in the UEFA Cup as well. He's won the League Cup with Sheffield Wednesday, beating Manchester United, we gooners like that. A veteran of two World Cups. He's won the MLS Cup twice. He's now a champion as a coach, was the coach in 2019, best coach in 2019 in the USL. A more formal introduction right there for Mr. John Harkes, Super Kevin Campbell.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be on with you. I'm honored, actually, to be here. So fantastic. I'm really looking forward to the show.
Awesome. I want to take you back a little bit to where it started before we kind of get stuck into the nuts and bolts of you coming to England, because your career, you were born into a Scottish family, raised here in the United States. You were at the University of Virginia, correct? One of our really good friends, Mike from the Gooners podcast, is very proud and wanted me to make sure that I mentioned this to you because he's an alumni. Difficult to say.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Basically, as you stated, Sophie, my mom was from Paisley. My dad was from Dundee. They did not come over to the States together. They actually met at a social club, Scots American Club, in my hometown in Kearney, New Jersey, where I think at that particular time, my dad served, played football when he was younger, served in the British Army. He was based in Cyprus and then came to the States to follow his sister, my Aunt Ethel, who was living in Detroit at the time. Long story short, he ends up, as you do, connecting with a lot of people in New York, the big city. He's on the music scene. My dad was played guitar, and he got to see Aretha Franklin, Frank Sinatra, and all these small little pubs in New York where he was like, you know, the secret Kevin and Sophie knock on the back door. Okay. You know, the whole UK connection there, Scottish, English, Irish, whatever it is. And he actually found his way over to New Jersey in Kearney, where my mom and I, and he met at a social club, Scots American Club, where all our youth teams used to train at and change downstairs. And then the whole European kind of, it was like little Scotland in New Jersey. Nobody knew what else was going on. And met, married, and I was born there and grew up with football in my blood and veins. And, you know, that's, and it took me to where I am, thank God, because football just saved me, you know. in a lot of ways, and we can talk about that another time. But you know, it gives you hope, and it brings you sometimes out of, you know, whether it be drugs, alcohol, poverty, you know, different, you know, social situations and pressures. And you know, for me, it was brilliant to get, you know, just follow football. So I'm very grateful for what it's brought me in my career. I'm very, very grateful.
Wow. You know, you went from all those spots and places. Cyprus, by the way, that's where my family are from, the motherland. The birth of Aphrodite, the island of love. I want to shift things a little bit because, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but were you a ball boy for the New York Cosmos? Is this a true story?
Yes, it is true. Yes, it was a short period of time, and I was trying to be a ball boy for a period of time, and I couldn't get on the list because it was so long. But what we used to do is just, as you do, you know, you pick up the ball, you get a ride over to the stadium. It was only about 18 minutes away from our home in Giant Stadium. And this was like the world all-star team playing in New York on the Cosmos in New Jersey. And, you know, Beckenbauer, Pelé, and everybody. Finally, I got pulled into a situation where somebody didn't show up. And they were asking me to be a ball boy because I was on a short list. And I said, yes. And I was steamed straight in. And yeah, I mean, you're in the tunnel. You're shaking hands. You're high-fiving with Pelé. And full circle later in life, when I was playing in the World Cup in 94, when we were hosting, Pelé, we were coming out to play against Colombia, who Pelé chose to win that World Cup at that time. A lot of pressure on us. And he was standing there and he goes, John, how are you? And he gives me a big hug. And everybody's looking at me like, what's happening here? And I'm like, I think I owe him money, you know? But when Pelé gives you a hug, you know you're going to go out and play well. So, yeah.
Wow.
Fantastic person. Great ambassador for the game, by the way.
Yeah, that's amazing. I had the pleasure of interviewing Carlos Alberto when he was part of the New York Cosmos group and team. I mean, I talk to KC about this all the time. Moments where you have to pinch yourself, and even as players, Kevin, when you meet Pelé or you're standing in front of Diego Maradona, you become a humble human too in front of a lot of these trailblazing heroes who've played the beautiful game at the highest level.
Well, you recognize what they actually stand for. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, because football is such a global game, but these are icons. There's players, there's good players, there's top players, and then there's elite, and then the icons. These boys are the icons right at the very top. The ears thin up there, Sophie.
That's very true.
Very fit it, up there.
Yeah, it is thin up there. And I want to fast forward because before, you know, the likes of, you know, the Deuce, Clint Dempsey, as most UK fans know him, Brian McBride, Landon Donovan, you know, now Christian Pulisic, McKennie, Dest, and, you know, Gio Reyna, there was the real trailblazer, and that was Mr. John Harkes. You know, you talk about the US team becoming more of a global team and putting themselves on the map. And that 94 World Cup was, of course, really important for US soccer, but also for some of these players. For example, something like this, where you find yourself all of a sudden playing alongside the Colombian captain Valderrama, the US ended up winning that game. But John, what did that mean to you in particular? And you kind of became the poster boy for US soccer, and know the pressure that maybe a Landon came under, a Kobe Jones, eventually, you know, a Christian Pulisic now, and of course, McKennie playing with, you know, Ronaldo at Juventus, and Dest playing with Messi and Reina at Dortmund. You were there from the real kind of progress of when the team came to fruition. Talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so back in the days before black and white TVs came out, I played football. And no, it was, I think as you reflect, you know, upon your career as you get older, you know, you know that you didn't get there on your own. There were so many different people that were involved in that happening for you or creating that environment. You know, for you to step through. But at the same time, and Kevin will tell you this as well, one of the things that you look for as a manager now in players is that drive and determination, that resilience, that, you know, we talk about mentality, but there's like a temperament that you have as a footballer. And I think I've always had that where I wanted to fight for things. I had that resilience about me. But that generation of players, and there was a lot of great players that we qualified for the previous World Cup, Kevin and Sophie, in 90. And that was the first time we had gotten back to the world stage in 40 years from the 1950 World Cup, where we actually had a great result against somebody in England. Which nobody could believe because they thought it was being reported back like, oh, the U.S. lost 11-0. And they're like, no, it was 1-0 U.S. But things, you know, for me, there's no accidents in timelines. It's driven by certain individuals and what you want to do with your career. And, you know, even for Kevin and what Kevin did, you know, for Arsenal and the way that he grew up, we had something to prove. We always did. And I think that generation of players took upon themselves the responsibility to get back to that World Cup stage. And when we did in 90, it was like, okay, we got there. It was almost like we were the tourists in 90 in Italy. And now in 94, we're hosting, there's even more pressure. So when you show that picture against El Pibe, you know, Valderrama, that's one of the top, you know, magicians in the central midfield in the world. And here we are, a nation that's kind of in a transition period of like getting people back on the footballing stage, the world stage of like, what does that mean to represent your country again? And it was a tough time. There was pressure, but at the same time, we were very grateful for the opportunity to step through that door and go into that platform. And not a lot of people can do that, but pulling off a result like that, we got a draw against Switzerland in the first game. We went into that match, which was in the Rose Bowl in California, completely sold out. I think it was about 110,000, 15,000.
Yeah,
something like
yeah,
that.
Easy.
And, so to pull off that upset and win that match 2-1, you know, meant that we were in a good position to go against Romania and compete and play. And, you know, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I look back on it and I think to myself, if we didn't have that success, there probably wouldn't be a Major League Soccer starting in 96, without a
100%.
Doubt. Yeah, and we that's what catapulted. That was the kind of instigator, you know, to really push the game forward in our country. And if you think about it, and you look at Major League Soccer today, we just completed, what, our 25th season? Compare that to the rest of the world. I remember flying over Sheffield Wednesday and going and explaining to my mates, this is the 150th anniversary of the club. And they're like, wait, what? So it gets to a point where you got to keep things in perspective, right? How much we're still in the beginning stages, those embryo stages of growing the game in this country at the professional level. So it was a big breakthrough for us. We were fortunate to be part of that. And there was a lot of quality players and managers that helped, you know, push the game on and be builders of the game in our country.
Yeah. I mean, KC, that team, Lalas, Brad Friedel was in the squad then, Claudio Reyna in the squad. Then you had Roy Wegerle, Kobe Jones, Tony Miola, who was groundbreaking as a goalkeeper here in the US too.
A lot of talent in that team. A lot of players in that team surprised a lot of the teams at international level, because what you got to understand is, because a lot of the players didn't play in Europe, so to speak, they were kind of discarded as, they'll be all right, but they won't be that good. But when you play against the USA, one thing you know, the USA are going to be fit, strong, dedicated, and they're going to be driven. And that's I think, that's what helped swell the love from the crowd. Because people have always grown up playing soccer, as it were, when they were young. And then obviously the so-called American sports take over as they get bigger, because that's what pays the bills, kind of thing.
Yeah. But
you guys, John, I remember watching you guys turned a lot of brain power in the crowds, in people watching on TV. And I'm sure Vegas must have loved you guys, because you were like making them some money, man. You were beating the odds and everything. So it was a tremendous, tremendous opportunity. And what a great story as well.
Yeah, it was. It's a crazy story, Kevin, to be honest with you, when you think about it, that we were, you know, at times, and even when, you know, you go from the national team and that kind of success that we had in those early years in 90 and mid 90s, growing the game and getting the results that we really needed to bring that kind of recognition, right? For, like you said, somebody would go like, oh, wait a minute, what are they doing beating Ireland? They tied Portugal, they beat Italy. Oh, okay, now they're competing. Oh, we had a friendly game against England, you know, the year before we beat them 2-0. Yeah, but that was just a friendly. And then, you know, they're never friendlies, as you know.
Exactly.
You know what's really interesting, you guys, is I've, as an expat now, I've been living in the States. It's going to be, I moved here 2 months before 9/11. And one of the things, two of my favorite teams ever, aside from the Invincibles and, you know, the 89 team, I love the men's team in 94 and the 99ers, of course, the women's team of 99, both trailblazing teams who changed the game forever here in the United States. What I love is the, and Kev and I talk about this a lot because Kev stays up at all hours to watch the NBA and the NFL, John. He's a American sports junkie for sure. And one of the things we always talk about is just this belief, this tenacity. And as a Brit coming over, because we Brits sometimes are like, oh, it's okay. You know, we're almost too polite and accept coming second. Whereas I learned a lot of lessons moving here about the American spirit and the American drive and athlete. And I really loved it and embraced it early on. And I think that was evident in your 94 team and also in the incredible 99ers team as well.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And it's interesting that as you focus on the spirit, and then people talk about that grit and determination, like even when you talk about generations of raising children and everything else, where's that grit? Where does it come from? A lot of it is, you know, you can discuss, there's two ways to look at that, the product of your environment and what you're involved in, but also as well, like, what are those goals and where do you want to be? Where do you see yourself as you grow up and get older? And I mean, we were coming out of nowhere. Like Kevin said earlier, we were kind of discarded and we were looked at like, you know, we were lucky to be in the 90 World Cup. We qualified for the first time. So people just went, yeah, whatever. But then the second game, we got blown away 5-1 against the Czechs at that point. And Skaravi, the guy destroyed us, man. He was just unbelievable. But then we lose 1-0 in a narrow match to Italy, the hosts, and we competed with them. And there's like little small victories in those type of results, you know. And you talk about the hope, well, and the belief. You know, it's funny because I've been a big fan of Ted Lasso, and people are cracking up over here.
I love it.
and it's the hope that kills you is the UK version, whereas we're like the hope that saves you. And like, yeah. And John Sheridan and all them were like, oh, Harksy, you're full of shit, you know. All you Americans, like, you all, Chris Packett, you all talk this and that, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, but optimism is actually an advantage in business, sport, and life. Because when you think about it, the pessimists are the ones that are complaining about the world. The realists are the ones that are talking about the world, but the optimists are the ones that are planning and creating their future. They're moving forward. And I've always been an optimist. So when somebody said, no, you're not going to make it in the UK, you're not going to be a footballer there, I was like, oh yeah, let me show you. When someone said, hey, you're not going to qualify for the World Cup, we're like, oh, right, let's just prove them wrong. So I guess we've always been in that kind of, I guess, a position of being the underdog, as they say.
Yeah.
But the biggest challenge is when you're not the underdog now, how do you actually perform? You know, and that mentality flips now. You're supposed to be the leaders and step on, and now you're supposed to drive the game, or you're supposed to, you know, whatever it may be in any arena that you're in. And that could be a big challenge. We went through that transition period too with the U.S. national team, and you saw we didn't qualify for the last World Cup, and everybody here.
That was a big, that was a huge disappointment not making it to Russia, especially for that World Cup, and especially when you had the likes of the new emerging stars like Pulisic. All right, let's move things along to this era and time, because you have a great World Cup and you join Wednesday, When they were in the second division, they'd just recently been relegated, John, but they were looking to go straight back up. I believe you were signed by Big Ron Atkinson. This is a different team. We'll get to that one. But you did sign for Big Ron.
Yeah, Big Ronnie Ronnie.
And what a character he was. Tell us about that experience, that moment. I'll just let you and Casey take over, because I'll tell you something. The new generation may not know who Big Ron is, but my goodness, he was a mix between John Gotti, Del Boy, and others. But I'll let you take it away from here.
Kevin?
The Big Ron was the right character. Listen, for me, anyway, John, he was obviously instrumental in the 3 degrees at West Bromwich Albion.
When I was coming out, kid,
Cyril Regis, Big Cyril, Brendan Batson, and Laurie Cunningham.
Yeah.
He was the manager of that West Bromwich Albion team who went all over the country, three black players playing in a football team. I was mesmerized. And he managed this team to perfection. The 3 degrees met the 3 degrees. It's a pretty iconic photograph. All of them, the two trios together.
Yeah.
And Big Ron made the most of these three players. And these three players were held in quite high esteem. Although there was the racism going about and all that, he had the balls to play them. This was really important. A young, impressionable kid growing up in Brixton who wanted to be a footballer, it's so important to have the role models, one thing, but the role models that are actually doing it is another. And to see these guys actually playing, you know, I remember meeting Big Ron at a charity do, and I asked him, I said, you know, Big Ron, these three were such an inspiration to me, and you played them. I said, what was it like for you? And he said to me, you know, he used to get hate mail. He said, but that made me wanted to play them even more. He said, not just because they were good. He said, but that racism stuff can't win. Do you know what I mean? That was powerful stuff. And obviously he moved on. He went to manage Manchester United, but I'll let you take it from here, John, because I just think, you know, in that day and age, it took some balls.
I agree with you, Kevin. And I actually, you know the story well with the 3 degrees and studied it. And I know of a lot of people in the States that, you know, support West Brom. And so you understand what that was like at that particular time. And it's an iconic time, to be honest with you. Like you said, it's historical. And if you look back on it, there were so many different people that took risks, you know, to do things, to challenge the norm in the society. And the racial, you know, discrimination that still exists today, you know, in our country, we still have a big issue with that, which we tackle every single day in conversations with our players as well. But he was there to give them a platform to play. He didn't care, you know, what color you were. It was just about, can you do the job for me? Can you play? And like you said, he was a motivator. He was to me, and I find that as you manage and, you know, you still have so much to learn, you're always improving every day, but you take these little things from each of your top managers that you love, and you don't try to make it, you know, like you don't try to be like them. You just make it your own and you use a little bit of that. What I took from Ron was that he was an equal opportunist. He gave everybody a shout. But if you had to earn it, Kevin, number one, you had to earn it.
Yeah.
But that when you put the work in, then you would enjoy it. And so he says, like, what a big, he was charismatic and champagne, you know, Ron and all that. And he was, but he put the work in. Mm-hmm. And that's how we beat Manchester United in the League Cup final in that first year of my career in England. 7 months later, I'm walking down Wembley steps, you know, lifting a winner's trophy. And I'm thinking, I'm playing against Brian Robson, who I had a poster on my wall, Captain Marvel. There's my hero. You know, there's
amazing.
Paul Ince. There's Steve Bruce. There's Mark Hughes. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing out here? But Big Ron,
and you're beating them.
Yeah. And Big Ron gave me that chance.
So do you guys, and Kev and I talk about this a lot because we have a lot of conversations, of course, on the chat. And then, you know, we talk about this too. There are blatant, disgusting examples of racism. And then is someone like Big Ron, in terms of what happened to him with listening to your guys' experiences, does something like that get lost in translation because of generational behavior and lexicon, Kevin? Do you think that's what happened to Big Ron, or do you think it was a little bit different to that? Because clearly he had a huge influence on a lot of multicultural players during his career as a manager.
Yeah, look, I think Big Ron made a mistake. Mm-hmm. It happens. I can't speak for Big Ron. All I could speak about is having met the guy, having spoken to him, he was first class. But obviously what happened. He said what he said. Mm-hmm. So he made a mistake. And, you know, his age group, this is no excuse, his age group of person is different to even my age group. He's a lot older than me. And whatever these people think, it came out. Sometimes people can think it, but it shouldn't come out of your mouth. But right. It came out of his mouth, unfortunately. And he was wired up. So, you know, he made a mistake. And
yeah,
that's life. We move on. Because, and that doesn't diminish what he done.
At Man United and other clubs as well. So, John, let's shift things along a little bit here. 164 appearances. You can correct me if I'm wrong at Sheffield Wednesday. But I believe that you even said yourself that the greatest season of your life was probably 93. You make it to the League Cup final, the FA Cup. Is it the Trevor Francis team? Is it this team?
It's
part of this team, and then the Rumbelows Cup team, of course.
It was
this motley crew. Kev's been part of this stuff before.
Well, I think, you know, Kevin will tell you winning is infectious, and when you win things, that carries over into the way that you approach the next game, the next season, and you want it back again. And so I think, you know, a lot of those players that were in the dressing room or experienced that first win at Wembley wanted more. And, you know, you see Carlton there and Viv Anderson, you know, Nigel Pearson in there, a great leader, and, you know, Roland Nielsen. I mean, some of the quality players that were in that side, the one thing that Ron Atkinson knew how to do was to put a team together, you know, without a doubt. He understood that. You know, tactically, in terms of the way our approach was to Manchester United, he out-coached Alex Ferguson. Mm-hmm. In that game, and we won that game. When we go to 93, yeah, we're building experience in 92 in UEFA Cups and everything else and challenging in that tournament. 93 was more about, like, how do we go out and play against a very good Arsenal team, a quality Arsenal side, and how do we – first of all, how do we keep them – and Ian Wright can easily catch me, and you know that. But anyway, I'm glad that I'm ahead of him at that point. I think it was more of like, we had to shut down Arsenal. How do we keep them off the score sheet was the biggest thing defensively, number one, in that approach. And then, you know, from the attacking side of it, can we put the ball in the back of the net? And we were capable of it. You know, we had the thing about us that hurt us a lot in terms of the rotation from the semifinals in that year to the finals and the replays and things like that was, to me, David Hurst was one of the top strikers. You know, Mark Bright, a quality striker as well. And they were picking up little injuries here and there. And Paul Warhurst was thrown into it up front, who was a center back in his original position. He had done well that season. So from our perspective, I think it was like we weren't firing on all cylinders, but we had opportunities to win those games, and we didn't. And it hurt a lot, man. Arsenal was a quality side. And that still stings me. Still stings me that way. Couldn't win one League Cup or FA Cup in the same year. It was a challenge. It was a challenge.
Well, John, I've got to tell you, it doesn't sting me. I
can't hear you, Kevin. There's something wrong with the audio. I can't hear you.
I could imagine there's something wrong with the audio.
If somebody help Kevin.
No, it's Well, let me tell you.
The hat's coming off. That's it. Let's go.
Let me tell you.
I love it.
Let me tell you, George Graham, he was a driller. He drilled us.
Yeah.
And you guys caused him some problems because you guys were a really good side. And I've got to pay you the ultimate respect in that Sheffield Wednesday team, because to be in two cup finals against Sheffield Wednesday in both cup finals, it was never done before. Yeah. So how we had to scheme you for the Milk Cup and then adjust a little bit in the FA Cup.
I love that you called it the Milk Cup.
Yeah, because that's what it was. It was the Milk
Cup.
Yeah. And listen, it was always going to be small margins because the teams were so close to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and luckily we got over the line. But in the FA Cup, I tell you what, in the replay, we got lucky at times. We did. We got lucky at times. And I think Brighty, he would want one of those chances back again, because normally he would stick one of them away.
Yeah. Hey, Brighty loves, by the way, Brighty loves to give some shit. Yeah. To be I'll tell you, and I say to him, I said, the one thing about Brighty's mentality as a striker is that even though he would miss the chances, he never stopped asking for the ball and demanding responsibility. That's what made him a little bit different. Yeah. But again, when he gives me stick about playing as a Yank, I'm just like, hey, son, I put the ball on your freaking noggin for the semifinal. I'll get Now, could you not put one away in the final?
Yeah, that's right.
Don't even get me started, Kevin.
Hey, by the way,
I love it.
Replay, he was lucky to stay on the pitch. Because if you remember, he gave Andy Lineker
an elbow.
He gave him an elbow, and the referee bottled it.
Yeah.
But, hey, listen, it would have spoiled the final anyway. It would have spoiled it. So, but the way the final ended, it was a bit of a relief because we'd played virtually to a standstill, John. And then Andy Lineker pops up with the winner, you know. So, what a replay. I know, John.
You see it now.
So, when you put the hat back on, then I stop.
You took the hat off and he just went guns blazing on you right there, John. You know, the truth is that, you know, back in the day, Sheffield Wednesday, you know, they're one of those sleeping giants right now. I think if an owner comes in, takes them over, you know, they go to great heights again. When I was growing up, and I remember, especially in the 80s, of course, you know, Hillsborough became synonymous with a very tragic event. But Hillsborough was always that place that you wanted to get to, because you knew if you progressed in the FA Cup semi-final, you were either going to play at Hillsborough or Villa Park. Sheffield Wednesday, this team, I wanted to talk to you because inside the dressing room, you take us beyond the white lines. And I wanted you and Casey to get into this a little bit because, you know, you talked about Ron Atkinson, but Trevor Francis, who was a trailblazing player, the first £1 million player, I believe, who did incredible things. And, you know, I think, was he a player manager when you first went, when he was at Sheffield Wednesday? But I wanted you to talk us through a little bit about him and some of the other. You also played for Jim Smith at Derby, and we'll get to your Derby days. But Trevor Francis, I think for the kids of today, they need to know kind of like who he was, because my goodness, he was for a while the soup du jour in English football.
Yeah, I mean, Trevor was transitioning into that player manager role. I know he had a short stint at QPR, didn't he? Trying to do the player manager role. I always thought as an American player and, you know, being in the English game, I always thought, man, that's such a difficult role. I don't know who in the competitive nature, plus inside the dressing room with players where you need to have the respect for the manager and, you know, respect for each other, who's next to you. And that's how you fight for a team, you know, a team oriented player. Having a player manager is difficult because I just thought, how do you manage that really properly? You know what I mean? Like, how do you become transparent in that way of picking the team sheet? You know, you put yourself in there. So for me, it was interesting to kind of, I had to focus on who I was and like try to get myself in the starting 11 every week. And I think it was harder for me as an American. You know, I had to be like the best player in training every single day to be considered. That's how I just felt. That's how I approached it, whether it was right or wrong. From Trevor's standpoint, I think he was trying to grow as a manager in his early years. And we had early success right away. And, you know, I mean, from our perspective, I think that could either kill you or it can raise you up to the next level. And I think losing both those finals in the to Arsenal really, really crushed Trevor at that point.
Wow. You know, KC talks a lot about influential players, whether they're in the dressing room or outside. And John, I hear you on the American thing, because still to this day, I think there's a stigma with American players in Europe. I really do, as well as the young American players are doing at Barcelona and Dortmund and Juventus. And also even, I think people forget about Zach Steffen at Manchester City playing under Guardiola. You know, Kev talks about players that really had an impact on you. And I think Chris Waddle had a major impact on you. Kev talks about Paul Davies and Rocastle and these kinds of players. But Chris Waddle leaving Marseille, coming to Wednesday, and again, at the time, very expensive signing. It showed Wednesday's ambition, the team that they were building. He had quite an impact on you, didn't he, as a player and a person?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you know, first of all, you know, when you're far removed from a player like that, you look up to him and you watch him play and you study him and you understand his skill levels and what he brings to the game on the football pitch. But it was more for me what I met Chris off the pitch. I thought, great mate, you know, a really endearing person. You know, he's just a salt of the earth type of player. He never acted like he was bigger than anybody else. He, you know, rolled up his sleeves and worked as hard as everybody else did. And, you know, there were times where he was on the opposite wing of me, and he was a left-footed inverted kind of midfielder coming inside, and I was the right-sided. You know, I used to give him shit a lot. My left was better than his right. But he, you know, it was great because the first thing Sophie and Kevin, what I did was I picked his brain right away. He looked at me like, who's this Yank and all that? But I picked his brain right away to make him laugh. And humor was is the first and the last thing in humanity. It can help you and it can break you and it can help you again. And he had loads of it. It's funny. I mean, funny guy. And he and I clicked on that way, on that level. But I asked him right away, like, hey, Chris, can you stay with me after training and do what you do on your, like, help me enjoy? And he would, yeah, no problem, Harksy. Let's go. Grab the stuff. And we would go out and do it. And I was like, whew, this guy's unbelievable. I'm going to be here. I'm going to be his worst pain in the ass he's ever. You know? But it worked really well. And just off the field, he was just such a great, great team guy. He really was. Had a great mindset for the game. And I was really surprised that he didn't continue in management. I guess he just didn't have the patience for it. You know, he was like, you got to have a lot of patience and, you know, resilience to get through as a coach and a manager as well. And but he had a great mind for the game. So he was always there to share. Great guy.
John, how did you get on with Nigel Pearson, John Sheridan, Roland Nielsen and Boyce?
Yeah, those players.
Some right characters.
All characters. And, you know, Roland was my roommate and he was like the quiet Swede, you know. He was just like, when he did talk up, you're like, oh, my God, he's gorgeous. No matter what he said, you're like, oh, flipping out, Roland, stop it. You're way too good looking. Shut up, you know. And yeah. Nigel Pearson was like a big brother to me. He just a natural hard man leadership kind of role. Like, and he laughed at you, but he did it in a, like, it was like a tough love kind of guy.
Right away, yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And like, even when you, well, he grabbed you by the neck and he was like, oh, you've done well, Harksy. Like, when I scored goal of the year that year in the first year against Derby, he was like, what was that all about? And then he grabbed me afterwards. He's like, oh, you've done well. I'm like, hey, you're hurting me. I'm like, I don't think you understand, Nigel, how strong you are. But he was a just a great guy to look up to and a great organizer. I mean, he saw the game from the back, obviously, as a center back. But a lot of people don't know in the cup run, you know, he scored so many quality key goals for us as well. So it was great in the air. Great off the field. Still in touch with him as well. Phil King, Roland Nielsen, Carlton Palmer, CP, white bulb head. He was fantastic. I love him. They're just all a great bunch of guys that even when the pressure's on you, we know how to wind each other up to have a laugh. And the banter in the dressing room was just unbelievable. I mean,
what kind, go on, Kev.
Do you still speak to Hursty?
David Hearst. What a player. Wow.
Yeah.
What a player.
Hearsty, to me, I was surprised he didn't go to Manchester United when he had the opportunity. Remember, Kevin? He had that chance.
Was it injury that done it?
No, I think it was, as Bono sings in U2, injured in doubt. I think it was doubt that caused him to go there, fear in himself to go to the next level. I hate to say that, but I honestly kept saying, I remember I was injured at the time and I was doing work with Smudgeo, Alan Smith, you know, the legendary physio. And Hearsty came in and out doing some extra strength work, and then he went back out on the pitch again. And I went out and I said, Alan, I thought Hearsty was leaving today. And he goes, for what? I go, Manchester United. I think they put a bid in. And I thought that was done deal. And he was like, oh, Johnny, I don't think he wants that level. And I'm like, what are you talking about? But he could have gone. He could have gone there.
That's for sure.
Yeah, Kevin, I just think some people, like, they create their own fear. I mean, we talk about mental health right now during COVID and how important that is for players, coaches, staff, you know, everybody, you know, civilians, everybody. It's just so important to connect with everybody. It's the most important thing. That was the number one thing that I focused on this past year in COVID as we played during the season, is just making sure that the players were okay. And I just think it's such a fragile thing. It really is. And some players have that overabundance of confidence, but it's also this little bit of insecurity that they put as a protective shell.
Yeah. And he was a really good player, David Hearst, and he definitely had injuries, but he was definitely one of those that could have gone on to greater things. And someone mentioned Paul Warhurst, because Warhurst did end up going to, didn't he go to, he went to Blackburn, but United, did he go to United? No, I'm thinking of Clayton Blackmore. Yeah.
To Blackburn.
Blackburn.
It was with Paul Warhurst, and really good player, good defender. And then he done a thing up front. And he scored some serious goals.
He did.
He was sharp. He knew where the goal was. He done really well for a good part of his career playing striker.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, I mean, asking you as a striker, what's one of the things that you think for yourself kind of led you to be the successful striker that you were? What's something that every striker needs to have?
Well, one thing you've got to do is you've got to be hard-headed, John, that's for sure. Because when you miss those chances, you know it's going to come, but you've got to stay focused. And you've got to have self-belief. You have to have self-belief. If you haven't got self-belief, you ain't going to do anything. So self-belief is definitely key, and confidence to playing football at definitely as you go up the levels. That's for sure.
Kev, it's interesting because that's a great question from John. And from us fans, it's easy for us to scream from the sidelines and the stands, right? You guys are the ones who've played the game and sweat and worn the cleats and cleaned up all the crap in plays that came before you that doesn't happen anymore in football. And that's part of the thing we love. Alan Shearer, you could argue, some of us fans think that he copped out going to Newcastle versus United, but we also kind of poo-poo the fact that maybe he really did want to go and play for his boyhood club and stuff like that. So, John, in the dressing room, players, you know, so much of today's talk is, you know, tapping players up and players talk and stuff like that. Back in the day, was it talked about a lot in the dressing room in terms of, oh, you could go like, you know, David Hearst, for example, or other players, you know, in terms of you could go play for this team, you should move.
I mean,
I mean, it's interesting. I think it'll be a different answer from Kevin based on, you know, being at a bigger club. I think the expectations, the realistic expectations of the clubs and where you're at. I think Sheffield Wednesday at that particular time was one of those clubs that people knew were a good club, had a brilliant following, always had the passionate fan base, filling Hillsborough, as you know. But I think it was kind of lifted up by Ron Atkinson's leadership. Mm-hmm. Ron Atkinson actually pushed and nudged us and kicked us to the next level. And so then all of a sudden in 92 season and the 93, the expectations came on even more. And I think those discussions started to happen more, Sophie. More so than what we did in 91 when we beat Manchester United for that League Cup final. We got promotion under Ron. the sky's the limit. I mean, I was devastated when I'm back in the Jersey Shore on the beach for the first vacation for me, you know, and I'm getting a phone call that he's leaving to go to Villa, and I'm devastated. And now I'm thinking, where are we going as a club? Because his leadership, he did everything. And so I think it's, you know, it's club to club based on what the expectations are in leadership, you know, in that club. And at Arsenal at that time, like you said, Kevin, earlier, you know, you talk about George and what kind of manager he was. And but even the people that were around you in Arsenal, the expectations are different, right?
Yeah.
And they're higher. So those conversations are going to happen more, Sophie, than what they were in our group. So that's why when I heard Manchester United at that time associated with her, see, I'm like, goodbye, go.
Yeah.
Like, why would we hesitate, you know? But that's just my perspective. It's not his.
I think sometimes as fans, we underestimate that, you know, at the same time as being an athlete and a professional player, that you're also humans, and therefore certain managers are going to resonate with you. Casey talks about the impact George Graham had on him. Brian Robson, when he became captain of West Brom and had that incredible day where they had the most infamous survival in Premier League history. And you played with Big Ron and Jim Smith and Bruce Arena, who a lot of UK, European and world fans may not know, but he is the Sir Alex Ferguson, in my opinion, of US soccer, an absolutely prolific manager. And so I think sometimes as fans, we don't take that into consideration, what and how it affects you players in the dressing room and in your life when a manager of that magnitude leaves.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think it's something that, even more so today in the generations, I think, you know, we're not going to be naive, but you have to learn how people learn, and you have to figure out what makes people tick. And in a generation of playing footballers now, where, you know, the old days where we had a player to stay at a club like a Ryan Giggs that stayed at Manchester United for how many years? How many seasons was it? I mean, it just doesn't exist anymore, to be fair. And it's like players are moving and moving and moving, and like, oh, I kissed a jersey and I'm playing for my club. Those days are gone, but at the same time, the manager that gave you that opportunity, I remember talking to Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, years later when he came to the States, you know, and they had the teams come over with Manchester United. And he said to me, you know, Harksey, you'll never forget the first manager that gave you that open opportunity. He goes, I loved as a manager giving players that chance. The guys that really deserved it, that fought for it, I love that. And there's a connection there. As much as, like you said, Sophie, there is that deep line connection that you want to play, and you'll go across that white line and you'll freaking die today to play for that manager. And there's some managers that don't manage like that. They don't, they're not really have that emotional investment in the players. They're just the tacticians, and this is our system. And do you fit? If you don't fit, goodbye. It's a different approach. Everybody can do it differently. There's no right or wrong way. But I think more so now you're seeing managers that need to have that emotional investment. You need to connect with that player, or it's going to be difficult to get the best out of them, especially in a short-term period of time.
Yeah. You then go to Derby, and we all remember the screamer you scored and beat Peter Shilton, the Great Wall of Shilton, in that game. I think it was like, I don't know, 40, 45 yards. It was an incredible goal. It was your first goal in English football. And then you go to Derby, the team that you scored the screamer against, and, you know, your career moves on. How was your time there? Was it a happy time for you at Derby after playing at Sheffield Wednesday? You loved the club. You played with so many great players. Yeah, how would you describe your time at Derby?
It was a different time, and I had a different role. I was coming in as being one of the experienced pros to help lift up a young squad, which was kind of strange for me, because I was like used to the Viv Andersons and the Nigel Pearsons of the world and the Peter Shirtlifts and all the older heads and Danny Wilsons and that and Sheridans. And I was like, oh, I'm the young guy. I can learn from them. And then, you know, I got the move, and I was going to play for Arthur Cox, actually, because Chris Waddle was really close to Arthur, and Arthur was asking for me. I was going to go to Everton with Peter Reid at that time.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kev's doing a La Liga stuff with Reedy right now.
All right. The legend. Yeah. You should ask him about that. I'd love to hear the full story on that. He was close to Trevor Francis at the time. And I was like, ooh, okay. And then I ended up going for Arthur Cox, and I went to Derby, and, you know, it was you know, looking to get a salary as well. That's part of it. I mean, and it was a better salary to step down out of the Premier League, which was a big, big decision for me. Did I have the same success there as I did at Wednesday? No, I didn't. But it was a different club and it was a different role. But that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. It was interesting because, you know, the ownership group, Pickering at that time, wanted to put together this team to get up to the next level. And we went to the playoff final and we lost to Leicester that year. And I think we outshot them 21-3. And yeah. It was one of those games. But as I explained to my Greenville Triumph team this morning, I don't want to hear we should have won that game and could have won that game. You didn't, because you didn't put the ball in the net. So that's the difference. And so it was hard times, but it was also growing the game. And then the next year, when I went out to West Ham on loan and then signed back with Major League Soccer, and I was up with Harry Redknapp, and, you know, and Jim was, you know, a coach that took me. Jim Smith was like a great, experienced, older head coach, but he was still at that time figuring out who's going to be at Derby for the next season, who's not. And he's looking at me like, are you going to this Major League Soccer league? What's happening, Harksey? And I'm like, I don't know if it's happening. So there was a lot of transitioning period of time at that point. And there's Bruce Arena there, and fantastic manager there. And, you know, we had a lot of success there at with Marco Echeverri from Bolivia. And, you know, we won 5 trophies in the first 3 years at DC United and kind of put us on the map. And it was fantastic. But there was just a lot of – it was different, Sophie, Derby County.
Yeah.
It was almost like, John, you got to find yourself and recreate yourself now. You're an older head in this club, and I wasn't ready for that.
I think Kev can relate, because when he was – Kev, and I'll let you speak for yourself, because when you're coming through Arsenal, he's like the young, bright star. And then years down the line, he finds himself – not only the captain of Everton, but the first ever black captain of Everton, which comes with incredible responsibility and pressure. And then Brian Robson makes you captain, Kev, at West Brom for that survival weekend and all of that jazz. And so there's a juxtaposition to you guys in terms of your journey a little bit. You start off as the starlets and then you end up being the responsible ones. And that doesn't happen to every player, really.
No. Sophie, it doesn't, but I think as you go through your career, and John makes a really good point, when you play with leaders, good characters and leaders, it rubs off on you if you're that type of person to take it on board. It has to rub off on you, because being around these guys is an education in itself. This ain't even about being on the pitch. This is being in the dressing room, being in around them, their mindset, how they get ready for games. And everybody's different, but you can see how they operate. And then you get on the pitch. As John said, and you always hear me say, Sophie, when you cross that white line, it's a totally different thing as a player. When you cross that white line, all the work's been done. That's where the work has to be done, and you know what to do. You have to execute. There's no excuses. You have to execute when you're across that white line. And when John was at Sheffield Wednesday could do it. But when you go to a so-called lesser team, they're looking to you to help them get across that white line to be able to execute. That is another level again. So you have to try and lean on all of the experience you've got to try and impart on some of these younger players. Because you know what, Sophie, John will tell you, you think players know, they don't know how to win at a bigger level. They don't. That's why they need to be shown. They need that culture. That's so important.
Yeah, I think sometimes we fans, we're very critical, but at the same time, I mean, I've only coached AYSO, and John will know what that is, and some of our US listeners will know what that is. But even at that level, I get irate, and they're kids, you know, but I want to win because I'm competitive, and I can't even imagine what it's like at a completely different level, professional level. You know, I want to win a game of darts against my mates, you know. So I think sometimes we're very critical, and in this day and age, it's all exasperated and, you know, inflamed by social media and stuff, John, isn't it? And
it is. Yeah. It's difficult. I mean, even growing up in a social media platform, you know, environment, it's even more difficult on our kids, because we didn't have to feel that peer pressure, you know, on those social media platforms either. You know, we talk about the suicide rate and the increases in the percentages of that and how it goes from year to year, especially during COVID times. And that's a massive challenge, you know, for us to kind of manage in a way, because there are so many cruel, evil people out there that just really push hate to the top of the level. And, you know, it's difficult, and you need, there's so many times where kids are struggling and they don't know who they are or what they're living for, or, and that part of it becomes even more of a challenge. I think going back to what KC was saying, that when you take on a new role, you want to take on some of that responsibility. That's what helps build culture. And those are the players you want in your club and your dressing room, because when you cross that line, you're crossing it together. Mm-hmm. It is a band of brothers, you know, mm-hmm. to be fair. And it's not rah-rah bullshit. It's not that. It's not that we're just, it's really true. Like, do I really trust you? If I'm going out on the pitch with Kevin, I'm saying, Kevin, I've got your back, mate. Mm-hmm. Like, I need you to make those runs in the behind to split the center backs. I will give you the ball. And if I don't, that's on me. Like, mm-hmm. But those are things that, you know, like, even when somebody's struggling on the pitch, you try to play a little bit harder yourself to lift them up. You know, there's mm-hmm. and you know that mental part of it is really important. But that's what brings a team, you know, a little bit more together, that bond, that cohesiveness. And I just think that self-reflection is huge in terms of growth. You know, you have to have an open heart and open mind. But in terms of growth, you really have to have a growth mindset to take in what players are teaching you. You know,
well, yeah, I mean, you lead on nicely to that, and I think, you know, you bring up some great points, and you know, you have a son, and Kevin has a son, and it's funny how you can arc, and I'm going to do a little bit of a quick fire with you at the end of this. We're going to let you go in just a sec, Coach, but I've got to bring up Greenville as well, but also this part, because. You know, Kevin's seen his son suffer an injury this season, and he was on a roll at Stoke City, and your son as well. I just want to post some of these pictures for our listeners to see, because Ian was and is a very talented football player. There was a great article. I can't remember where this appeared, but you can tell me, where they had him kind of emulate some of your moves and stuff like that. And obviously Kevin's son Tyrese plays for Scott. And your son has signed for Dundee United. I'm not sure if he's still playing for them, but you can correct me. But I wanted you both to kind of talk a little bit about, because inside the dressing room is about, you know, your experiences as players, camaraderie, what the fans don't see. And a lot of the times these days, so much is said on social media. I kind of don't want to know it, because I love the mystery of what used to be behind the lines and inside the dressing room. And now you both have sons. I just wanted you both to kind of like let us know how that feels and what your experiences are now for them and what you're teaching them versus what you learned. Go on, John.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. For Ian, you know, he had 2 years, you know, he went to university, got his degree at Wake Forest, played football there, and then came out and signed with, you know, DC United, the club that I played for. And I think it's always difficult, you know, for your son. And by the way, my wife played as a pro, and my two daughters
yes.
as well. So it's in the family. It's in our blood. My daughter, Lily, will break down the Liverpool match with me, and she'll be like throwing a new club book all over the room. I'm like, easy, girl. You know, but it's a passionate family, and we're all competitive. And but with Ian, it's just, look, I mean, there's two things. There's one, you always – you're proud of them as a character, who they are as a character, you know, and what they stand for as a young man. That's the number one. I don't give a crap what they do in football or whatever profession they do. You know, you're a fireman, police officer. do it the best you can. That's what we've told all our kids, you know. And with him, he's followed his dreams, and he's been with Dundee United now for 2.5 years, finishing his third season. He signed for another 2 years. He's playing every single week in 90 minutes plus. He's doing well. He's making, you know, Scottish team of the week now and again, and he's growing as a player. He's adding things to his game. It's a different style of play in Scotland. I mean, it just is. And but he's benefiting and he loves it. And I think there's always that time where, you know, Sophie, you had said it earlier, humanity. Like, we're human. And so the football demands and the expectations can get so unrealistic that, you know, players, never mind your son, but players, they struggle to find out who their identity is and what they are. So for my son, is like every day I check in with him first as my son. And then we talk football. And if he wants to get my opinion on things, I give him my opinion. But I always let them lead it, you know, because I never want to be too intrusive in what they know. I don't want to be the dad that, I'm a manager, you need to listen to my tactics. You never want to do that, because what it does is you don't know the everyday work that goes into what they're doing. So how dare you step over the line and cross that? So understanding that what your role is first as a father, and then in the footballing capacity. Kevin, I don't know if it's the same for you.
100, John. I'll be honest with you. I'm just like you. I'm a proud dad. Even when I was driving him around, going to his games, when he was at Manchester City, etc., I was on the side and I would just keep quiet. I'll be one of the football dads, loving it. I was loving it. Play the game. They have to go back on the coach or whatever, and we drive back, pick him up, get him something to eat or whatever, and I wouldn't say a word. I'll drive him home. If he wanted to speak to me, he speaks to me. If he wants to put his headphones on, he could put his headphones on. Because I think a lot of the problem is, because we've been pros, it will be easy for us to say things that will muddle the kids up, because they're getting information from the coaches. And then if they're getting information from dad as well, as John said, we don't know what work they're doing in all the build-up to these games, etc. So I would never step on any coach. If he's got anything to ask me, he can ask me. I'm just a very proud dad to have a son who wants to follow his dreams. And if he wants to follow it, do it to the best of your ability. And that's what he's doing. So I'm proud. That's it, really. I don't tell him anything that I shouldn't.
It gets harder. He'll probably
say, shut up, dad, anyway. So that's
Exactly. They do the, no, they Kevin, they do the silence one. They go, okay, never mind.
I love that. And remember, it can't be easy for them, because you've both been trailblazers, right? So as a kid, I'll tell you, trying to live up to like a big brother. It's not easy. It's not easy.
No. I've got a question for John.
Yeah.
John, go for it. Did you play with Joe Max Moore?
I did, on the national team with Joe Max, and also with New England Revolution.
Right. Have you got any stories for me about that? Because you know what? He made me laugh so much, especially if he was playing cards, John.
Talk about a competitive nature, by the way.
I love it.
Boy, unbelievable. Oh, he's on fire, Kevin. On fire.
He's unbelievable.
And you could get him going, couldn't you? You especially probably wound him up.
Easy. He was so easy. Playing cards. Got it, Derek. He would get up and he would flip chairs. Oh my God.
That's unbelievable.
You would have a story on him, definitely.
He's unbelievable. Playing cards with him. Think about this. He, Roy Wegerle, Brian McBride, and Friedel in the same room were all playing cards together. Joe Max Moore. And Wegerle's winding him up and winning games, and we're all like losing money, and Joe is like $3,000 in the hole, and he's just going nuts. And Kevin probably knows what his reaction is. Like, tip the table over, walk out, and then we wouldn't even get upset by it. We were like, all right, Joe, good night. And then we would fix the table again and we start playing. And he'd come back in an hour later and go, "You're still going? Oh, can, still I get back in? Can I get back in?" I'm like,
"Get back in. Yeah, I want to get back in. Get some of this MF money. I want to get back."
You know what? Brilliant. So many players suffered because they were so competitive on the pitch, even when they played cards or whatever, they had to win, right? That winning, that winning mentality. And Roy Wegerle, I mean, what a sensation he was at QPR for a while. What a player, right?
Silky smooth player, man.
Such a silky smooth player. And then Friedel, of course, went on to be, you know, the US produced really good goalkeepers. And
I'm a big fan of Brian McBride and Clint Dempsey.
I love the Deuce.
I love Brian McBride and Clint Dempsey just because they were entertainers, right? I mean, you look at goal scorers like Kevin and you look at Ian Wright and you look at all these different quality goal scorers that came through the systems and that. But there was this, there was this sense of like not just entertainment, like with the Deuce. So like he can try things that people weren't trying and pull them off. But then you like Brian McBride had this kind of he had like this old school mentality, and his he was just one of the most courageous players I've seen. Mm-hmm. Like diving headers in the box, we go across someone's boot to the side, and his he was just so like that old school mentality in the UK.
Old school number nine. I played with he was excellent. Brian was excellent and a really good lad as well.
Oh, quality people. Yeah, great people.
And it's true, like McBride, that six-yard box stuff doesn't really happen as much, does it, as it used to. I love that, miss that. And obviously, I think Dempsey kind of surprised people, wonder goals. And, of course, we all remember the goal. Was it in the Europa League, that wonder goal against?
Chipped it.
That was great. Right, John, I've had you for an hour and six. I know you're a very busy coach. I want you to tell everyone about Greenville a little bit, and then I'm going to get you out on five quick fires as part of Inside the Dressing Room, okay? So everyone calls this Sophie time. It's otherwise known as extra time.
Okay, I love it.
Okay, so time. I think people don't realize how fun the USL is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've always been a huge fan of the USL. You guys won the, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you won the championship in your inaugural season. You were coach of the year. I know it ended in weird circumstances because of COVID and stuff like that. But tell us about Greenville.
Yeah.
Tell us about being a coach after being a player and what that means to you right now.
Yeah, I mean, Greenville is, you know, it's a smaller club. It's in a small town in South Carolina. It's actually close to Clemson University. So Clemson, American football, it's hard to talk about growing the game and growing the brand. They're like, yeah, I'll come out and see the game. What? You play soccer? I'm like, what? So it's a great club. I mean, it's been, you know, 2 years running. We built it from scratch. I actually take on a lot of responsibility in the U.S. of growing the game in this country. And it's not like I'm a dreamer. I'm more of like, you know, you see the tier structure in England. You see the tier structure in every other country in the world. We need to not just build up Major League Soccer, which I, you know, helped be part of in 96 in its first year, to where it is today. So we built that top Division One level up high. Then we want to build the second and third divisions. And so from a USL, United Soccer League standpoint, and that's our ownership, that's Joe Irwin on my far right, his son Doug, and then Chris Lewis, our president, on the left. We built it from nothing. And it was based on, like, you know, you've got to get the right players and characters, obviously, in your roster, number one. But then you've got to create and build that culture within your front office. And then you've got to get out into the community and be a club for the community. So you're doing all the small things and the detail-oriented things that build to the, you know, that club up. But for the 2 years, the first year we went to the final and we lost. It was against North Texas, which was FC Dallas's, you know, U.S. Mm-hmm. And then this past year we won it, Sophie. We won the championship.
Yep.
We were number one all year from the beginning to the end. And for me, everywhere in Europe, when you're number one in your league table, you're number one. So the whole playoff system, I still kind of hate, but I don't want to go into that. But we did a great job, and you know, we won the championship. So we went to two finals in our first 2 years. We're having a lot of success, and we're still growing the brand off the field. I'm enjoying being a manager. I love growing as a manager, and learning more about myself and those challenges. And, you know, every manager, they don't want to admit it. You have blind spots, just like every player has blind spots. And you sometimes don't know them. So it's important. I just took the U.S. Pro coaching course right this year, and I just finished that, a whole year license course. And, man, did it open up my eyes to so many different things. But it also kind of – it almost like kind of cemented – that the things I am doing in your gut instincts, that you see the game and observation and identification of things, that you're right, that you don't need to have this self-doubt. And so that's part of it too, in finding that balance. So I'm still a young coach. I love managing. I got a lot to learn. I'm having fun. I'm having success, but I'm just creating opportunities for other people. And we want to grow the games at the lower level so that now you have the respect of first and second and third divisions in this country. So that maybe 10, 15 years from now, people go, wow, look at that pyramid structure. It is really strong in the U.S. now. And it creates opportunities for players to come over and play.
Fantastic. I love that. I love it. And Kev, it's so important as well, as like MLS is becoming a juggernaut, of course, and there's lots of expansion teams and they've increased the league. But the USL and what happens at that grassroots level and what can eventually become what MLS is, it's just so important. And I love how players like John are at the helm of teams, Landon Donovan as well, John as well. And, you know, I think it's really important that as much as MLS is growing, which is more of an investment platform, let's be honest, and I cover it week in, week out here in LA with LAFC and LA Galaxy. But it's also, I think, still reliant on superstars. You know, Chicharito hasn't really hit the heights. Zlatan was a superstar. Beckham, you know, you had Lampard, Pirlo, David Villa here. Jovinko became like more of a, I still think they're a little bit reliant on that.
I think, me personally, I think the USL is the foundation of American soccer.
Yeah.
American football is the other sport. American, the soccer is what you guys are doing, is going to build that platform to make it stronger, because there are so many good young players who play up to a certain level and they can't all go into MLS.
Yeah.
There has to be somewhere for them to go and develop. And that's what you guys are providing, John.
So, I agree.
Listen, I'll take my hat off to you, John.
Yeah, and like Mike says from Gunnar's podcast, like Didier Drogba getting involved in Phoenix Rising and stuff like that. John, you can help everyone understand here the importance of USL and what it means to the landscape overall, you know?
Yeah, I think it's you know, the Division II, the USL Championship, became the second, I think the first fastest growing second division in the world in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about what they're growing the game there, like you said with Didier, you know, I spoke to Didier Drogba when I was out at Phoenix and a while ago, just studying their club and who the way they were growing their club. And he was saying, I just love it. I love the game and I want to help grow the game. And I think it's important to have those celebrities, which you mentioned, Sophie, but not too reliant on them to actually carry the game forward. And give, you know, the platforms to other players. Like, this to me is a second and third division that's a pathway to the pros, realistically. Yeah. And like you said, Kevin, there's a lot of guys that compete and play and they don't make it in their first or second year, but that gives them a chance to actually become like a real player. Like, what's it like to be a pro player on a day in, day out basis? And so if they get those experiences, then they grow and they mature. And there's a lot of players, even in the Bundesliga, that they believe in terms of those late bloomers. You know, they come into 24, 25 years old. Now they get it. They have that maturity that's in there, plus their ability. And then they have that real belief. And then all of a sudden it takes off for them. They need somewhere to play and compete. And there's nowhere better to get that landscape. So I think we're building that foundation now. And it's important that people believe in that foundation. We need more investors. I mean, the country itself, there's so many countries thrown into this one country. I mean, it's massive. It's a massive country. So tapping into it all over the country and trying to get into those little nooks and crannies and those little dark areas where, you know, you want to open up the game, and it's education, right, for everybody that's growing the game. That's all we're trying to do.
Yeah. Brilliant. No, I love it. Okay, so I'm gonna get you out on these quick fire ones, okay?
Because what are we doing here?
We're going inside the dressing room, so I want to know because Kev shared his the worst ever away dressing rooms you played in England.
Oh God, it must have been the Den.
It comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Millwall.
First of all, I was the first club that for Derby County. We played there away in a playoff game. We beat them at home, and then we went away. And Sophie, we almost didn't make it out of that stadium.
That when they came in the pitch, is that when they were attacking you on the pitch?
Yes, Kevin. There was
three
times we came back on. We were chased off back on, and the third time I'm sitting there with Paul Simpson, and he's like, Hoxie, the same. We've got to go back out, mate. And I'm like, who's going back out? We're not going back out. And I remember when you got the old studs on, Kevin, and you're sliding down the tunnel, and you're like, whoa. And it's like, get your skates on, Maureen, you know, and everyone's like flying down.
Oh, I love it.
Man, it was brilliant.
Dressing room you went into, an away dressing room where you were like, oh, wow. It being in awe, not just the dressing room, but the stadium. Like, what was that first club? Being an American going to England, what was the first kind of like, wow, I'm playing here moment?
Arsenal.
Get in!
Arsenal. I fell in love with the old Highbury. I fell in love with it. And my dad actually was a guest at Arsenal, and he was staying with me and got to go upstairs. And I think it was Hani, God, I want to get his name right, who invited my dad up, and he had a steak dinner, a cigar, a freaking proper like Scotch whiskey from the Highland. I'm like, what's going on, Dad? And here we are losing to Arsenal, like maybe 7-1 that day. I don't want to talk about it.
Did you play? Did you play in that game?
Oh, I can't see you right now. I'm going over my team sheet tomorrow.
I love it. Absolutely brilliant. John, best dressing room team talk you were ever a part of that you can remember as a player?
Yeah, it was at Wembley. It was Ron Atkinson's prior to Manchester United, the win in that final. I've never felt so motivated in my life. And it was just just the way that, you know, he commands the room, you know, and it's almost like less is more. He didn't have to say too much, but what he did say, like the work we had put in, Kevin, like you say, you put the work in. That was all the exams and the school and everything. Here comes the big final test for you on the weekend. And there was that match. But the way that he kind of prepped it and built us up, and he made us feel like we were the underdog. He used that to his advantage. And
brilliant.
The talk that he said, he goes, the one thing he said in that dressing room, I do remember this. He said, make sure that everybody in their supporter section remembers your name when you walk off the pitch. And I just was like,
powerful.
Yeah, I'm sitting there going, what does that mean?
Well, you did that in your screamer against Derby. And let's not forget the goal you scored against Arsenal. I was going to ask you, what's your favorite goal?
Kevin. I can't believe that Merson equalized with a dodgy half volley and deflected off of 17 people and went in.
They all count the same, John.
Well, to score the first goal in that final was from a personal standpoint, I was just like, what's happening here? You know, early in the game, Kevin, if you remember, and
well, it was what free kick.
Yeah, it was. We worked it, and you know, if it wasn't for Colton Palmer's assist in the other game that you guys won. And the 7 yards out. clear your line, Carlton. But it was a great game. That was a great game.
I love it. Brilliant stuff. And then I'll get you out on this one, of course. You're going to have to tell us your best and worst ever roommate, because there's rumors of, you know, players that fart a lot. Back in the day, you had to double up, you know. So who is your best and least favorite roomie?
Oh my God. Chris Waddle, best roommate. I just couldn't stop laughing with him.
Did he used to sing to you, John? Was he a singer? Because we all remember Diamond Lights.
Yeah, Diamond Lights, please. I mean, the Diamond Lights shout. I mean, with him and how white could they be, by the way, in that video?
Darling, I love you. I even remember the lyrics.
Oh, God.
I mean, just somebody choreograph that. Just give them some dance moves. And a little bit of soul. Just a little bit of soul.
That was so good.
What are you doing, man? You know, if I could fast forward today, I don't think Chris Waddle would be in the Black Pumas. But anyway, Chris Waddle, best. Worst, probably Carlton Palmer, because he just never stopped talking. Being the place to be, you know what I mean? You know, Hawks, you know, I had to put this Armani on. It was the last one I had in the dressing room. I love Carlton. He's great.
Brilliant stuff. And then toughest opponent you ever played against and then swap shirts with. Who's your favorite shirt swapper?
At a club level or national team level?
Either one. Both.
Toughest opponent was Romario for Brazil.
Ooh.
Couldn't get close to him.
You know what? You only lost 1-0 in that 94 World Cup. I mean, that was quite the game. That was unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah,
that was fantastic. And then, you know, again, I think, you know, playing against quality players like a Brian Robson back in the day where he was still making it. You know what I mean? He was still there. He wasn't his prime, so to speak, but he was still Captain Marvel to me. And I thought, wow, what a player, you know? And I mean, Baggio from Italy, you know, playing against Baggio and Donadoni were just phenomenal. The quality midfielders that ran you to the ground, but just made you think all the time about technique, weight of the pass, all that.
Yeah.
Brilliant players.
And Mike's right? That was a July 4 game. That was like, my God, what a moment, what a time. Yeah. This has been absolutely epic, right, Super Kev? I love it. What a great conversation with John.
Great to see you. Let alone, it's great, even greater to speak to you, my man.
Yeah, great to see you, Kevin. Great to see you, son. Thank you guys for having me on, Sophie.
Thank you so much. I hope you can come back and have another conversation with us. Maybe we can talk a little Arsenal and get your take on that. And good luck to Greenville and everything you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Much love.
I heard Greenville is, we're taking on Arsenal at the Emirates next preseason. We've got to work on it, Kevin. Let's get it going.
I would love it.
Take care, guys. Take care, John.
And good luck to Ian as well. Take care, mate. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Brilliant stuff there from John, Casey. Great stories, right? Great guy. Love it. Great. Before we go, I just have to let everyone know about the Patrick Vieira signed framed Arsenal shirt that's up for grabs this weekend at footballprizes.co.uk. Make sure you go get your ticket. You guys will be giving a free one away on Thursday, so you don't want to miss out on that. But this is what I love about Inside the Dressing Room. These stories that take you back, you get inside the mind of the player, his whole experience, Kev, and I just love bringing you together with other players and us having these great conversations.
You know, Sophie, the fact of the matter is that man there is a massive trailblazer, and I don't think a lot of people actually take that into consideration. He was the first American to kick here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He was the first, the very first, the Premier. And he done the business, and he won trophies, and he scored goals, and he performed. And he wasn't a bench player. He was a starter in a really good Sheffield Wednesday team. Really good guy.
And there was a stigma to American players back then, Kev. They didn't take him seriously. They didn't think they were worthy. He had to overcome a lot of hurdles and obstacles, you know, was lucky to get a great manager like Ron Atkinson who believed in him. And so, yeah, I love the juxtaposition and the stories of your sons and how, you know, they're both on their journeys too. Because as ex-players, when you can have daughters who go into the game, sons who go in the game, and either way, you just want them to do well, and you kind of, you know, give them your wisdom in terms of all the things you've learned.
Sophie, here's the crazy thing. Do you know, John and I are ex-players.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what I found myself doing at the side of the pitch? Having to grab other parents and move them away from the pitch. Because they're getting so wound up.
Yeah.
About because their son's not performing or what they thought he's not performing.
Yeah.
And I had to grab them and just move them away from the pitch. Look in their eyes and say, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, he's not." I said, No, what are you doing? Because at the time, Sophie, you're going to love this. They were 9 years old, Sophie. The boys right. were 9 years old. They were under 10s. They were 9 years old. And the parent was losing his head because his son had misplaced the pass. That's not right.
Kevin, honestly, and Mike will tell you from the Gooners pod, coaching AYSO, I'm telling you, the parents are a bigger problem than the kids.
Yes.
The parents are like insane, literally insane.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. Well, look, brilliant stuff today, Kev. We're going to be back tomorrow. We've got a double show tomorrow. We've got a preview for Olympiacos, and we've also got Kevin Says tomorrow. Kevin's got some superb topics lined up for you, so you're not going to want to miss that. Keep an eye out on the Highbury Squad Twitter for the times for tomorrow. I believe we have Andoni Sulis from Gazeta.gr, who's an Olympiacos expert, at 7:30. And then immediately following from that, we are going to go out with Kevin Says. So you've got a double tomorrow night, you guys, which I can't wait for. Kev, brilliant show as always. Thank you so much. Love Inside the Dressing Room. It is one of my favorites. I just love hearing footballers just go. Brilliant stuff.
Sophie, and what I will say to all the Arsenal fans is, it's unbelievable what Sophie does. Getting the different people on to give you a different look at the game. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I love being a part of In the Dressing Room. And you know what, Gooners? It's always Arsenal. You know that. And we've got to beat Olympiacos. So let's get ready tomorrow. Up the Arsenal.